This is a Slog Audio Caching Podcast, produced by Paul Connor Packy of St. Louis, Missouri. November the 26th, 2006. Episode number 46. Interview with Robert Leip, creator of GPS Babble.
Welcome to episode number 46. This is Paul Conopacki, a member of SLAGA, the St. Louis Area Geocachers Association. In this podcast, I interview geocachers and land managers and record audio at geocaching events. Before we get to the interview with Robert Leip, I'd like to bring you up to date on a few local events. By the time this podcast is published, the event will be over, but our annual SLAGA Winter Meet and Greet, formerly called our annual Christmas party, it's being held at the same restaurant banquet room as last year's event. Just like last year, it's being hosted by Strider and Crow's Feet 30. You pay for your own meal, and it's an all-you-can-eat buffet. There will be an optional gift exchange, and all small kids will get a gift. There will be the usual GeoCoin Discovery Zone. Another event that is coming up is the Winter Potluck. It will be held on January 20th, 2007 at the Learning Center at Greensfelder County Park. That's located behind Six Flags in Eureka, Missouri. The St. Louis County Parks Department has again allowed us to use a Learning Center for this event. And last, MOGA 2007 registration is going well. A week ago, Mike Griffin and I shot a promo video which has been published on the internet. Even though MOGA is not technically a SLAGA event, it has been managed and staffed by SLAGA members in all the 4 years it has been in existence. Mike would really like another Midwest geocaching organization to take over the event next year and subsequent years. Check the SLAGA website, www.geostl.com, for more information about these and other upcoming events. You are about to hear a Skype out call I did with Robert Leip. During our conversation, I learned that there is a new geocaching podcast being produced in Australia. The host, Darren Osborne, interviewed Clyde, who is the creator of GSAC. I added a link to the podcast on my webpage at podcast.geostl.com if you'd like to check out the first two episodes of his podcast. The first few minutes of this next interview is Robert and I getting the call connected and talking about podcasting phenomena. Then we launch into the formal interview. As usual, if you hear this sound, it means there has been a change in the direction of the conversation. So here we go. Okay, we're recording. Shutting down a bunch of things here. I really don't quite have everything down here. Here we go.
I don't think those computer things are going to catch on.
I don't know. I think it's a passing fad.
Sometimes I miss tin cans and strings.
The last time I bugged you, you weren't quite sure what podcasting was. Have a better idea now, or have you heard any of my podcasts?
I'll confess I probably should have, but but no, so far my exposure to podcasts have been, you know, Tiki Bar TV.
That's at the top of my list.
Yes, I'm slowly coming into the 2000s. I've not ventured into any of the geocaching podcasts, although I did listen to the interview with Clyde just a couple days ago.
Oh, really? Do you know who did that one?
It's on the forums at gsac.net. I think it's in Australian because, well, Clyde's Australian.
They'd have better access to him, although it's a flat world out there these days, so...
Actually, a lot of the math in GPS Babble would be easier if it was a flat world.
True. X and Y
coordinates. Pythagorean is way easier to get around than great circle math.
I do like the X and Y coordinate stuff myself from high school. What other podcasts do you listen to, or what kind are you planning to listen to now that you have your iPod?
One of the biggest uses I've found for the video iPod is I have a 10-year-old son who had started taking a bend toward modern music that made my hair curl. So I've been using it to find old, you know, 80s era videos and turn him on to, you know, because a Peter Gabriel video, you know, the wacky claymation stuff,
Sledgehammer.
You know, it turns out, right, I mean, sledgehammer, digging in the dirt, steam.
Yeah.
You know, so I now have him running around singing songs from way before he was born. But I rescued him from the, you know, the Britneys of the world. He's not singing Fergie anymore in his Christian school.
Where did you hear those lyrics, boy?
You know, so instead he's singing, you know, Lamb Lies Down on Broadway from 1973 Genesis.
Rather than Shake Your Booty.
Right. London, London Bridge.
This is Paul Kanapaki, and I'm on a Skype out call with Robert Leip, the GPS Babel developer. I met you at one of the Slaga geocaching picnics. Can you tell us a little bit more about who Robert Leip is and how you got to where you are today?
I grew up in southern Illinois, Carbondale, Pomona area. Moved to Nashville in 87, 88. The reason we've run into each other at Slaga is because I do have family. My wife's family is in St. Louis area. Although I'm in Nashville, I have met face-to-face several St. Louis area cachers. I've done lots of St. Louis area caches. I know several of the regulars there. So,
how often do you get to St. Louis?
Not as often as I used to. Around 03 and 04, I would go a couple times a year and make week-long stays. Usually after those stays, I would get confused emails from St. Louis area cachers wondering why an out-of-towner was doing, you know, 150 caches in a week. In 03, that was a big deal. Why is a traveler doing a six-part multi in 44 Forest or whatever? But when you have a week of time on your hands at the in-laws, you get a lot of caching in. I've not been there nearly that frequently and that hardcore as much in later years.
Well, what brought you to Nashville?
I'm actually just south of Nashville in Franklin, Tennessee. I transferred with Tandy. I was the regional Phoenix Training and Support Center specialist. Tandy was the business products division, so I came here with my job as a computer guy years and years ago.
And that's Tandy as it's related to Radio Shack, that we know it?
Right. Tandy was the business products division of Radio Shack.
Are you one of the lucky ones who gets to work out of their home, or do you have to report to the office and do the whole Dilbert cubicle thing?
Well, I left Tandy shortly after coming to Nashville. I'm a software engineer by trade now.
How did you get into programming then? Were you grow up being interested in computers, or were you always interested in technology?
My dad ran a CB radio repair shop when I was a kid. So I always had access to technology. You know, I always had schematics and soldering irons and gadgets to play with and, you know, books to learn from. So early on, I was drawn toward the technology. I've been a programmer of some type on systems for 25 years or more.
What kind of computer do you own right now?
Well, looking around the room, I count about 8 computers. So,
and I bet you they all run either Linux or Unix?
Linux, Unix. I actually bought a Windows system to do GPS Babel after living Windows-free for many years before that. Several Unix systems. There's 2 Suns here. Lots of not terribly mainstream stuff.
Does open source necessarily mean you're giving away free to the world?
I think open source, kind of by definition, if you're publishing a source, it's hard to charge for the program. Certainly, my own personal experience, it means you're giving it away. I watch somewhere between 400 and 600 downloads a day of GPS Babel. The download link is nestled between PayPal links. And amazingly, those links don't get clicked on nearly 400 to 600 times a day.
The one like, please donate?
Yep.
Button, okay.
There are organizations with projects much, much larger than GPS Babel. I don't know where the money comes from. If I were actually making this my day job, I would do something about that. The reality is I created GPS Babel to solve a problem for myself because I'm a selfish, selfish man. You know, it's the classic scratching your own itch development. You know, because I run Unix systems, I needed a program that transferred coordinates to my first GPS. The program I found to do it was terrible. I spent hours and hours and hours trying to fix it. It's like, I can do better than this. Some of that code is actually the Magellan protocol module in GPS Babel now.
Well, when did you start GPS Babel? What does it do, and at what point did that get integrated into behind the scenes with GSAC?
On about my sixth cache, I had mistyped coordinates. This would have been December of 01. And it occurred to me, why am I typing coordinates? You're free to laugh. It's like a computer guy. I can't type, two six-digit numbers. But I spent a long time looking for a cache that was, a tenth of a degree away or something silly. So I created GPS Babel to transfer my own waypoints. I made it available to others middle of 2002 or so, when it occurred to me that, hey, this program might be useful to others. Being a Unixy guy, I have no visual sense of aesthetics.
You like command lines, basically.
I like simple, effective tools that do heavy lifting. They can be integrated behind domain-specific tools. The poster child of this is GSAC. GPS Babel is not a geocaching program. It's not a waypoint manager. It doesn't have geocaching-specific stuff in it. There's a lot of heavy lifting that GPS Babel does Clyde is very glad to not have to do. For example, we have reverse-engineered and implemented over 100 file formats. We support over 100 different GPS receivers. GSAC, while one such tool, isn't the only one that uses GPS Babel. Another one that's perhaps less known, Google Earth, uses GPS Babel for its GPX file imports and all of its GPS receiver communications.
So if I go into GSAC and I say send to GPS, there's some of your code being run underneath because you've reverse engineered or helped determine how to communicate with that particular device.
Right. Well, almost all of the file imports and exports, things like the filtering within a polygon, filtering points within a route, caches within a given radius, all that filtering along a road, that's all GPS Babel under the hood.
Even though you may be guiding it, you may get contributions from other people because it's technically open source?
Right. That's one of the highlights of having it open source, in fact. Well, not coincidentally, GPS Babel does everything I wanted to do and has done so for a very long time. But other folks come along. For example, right now, Olaf Klein, a developer in Germany, he's very, very plugged into motorcycle routing programs in Europe. I have been amazed at how many subcultures there are in GPS stuff. The paraglider people want one set of features, and the programs that ruled the paraglider, parasailer market versus the European motorcycling crowd versus the bicycle heart rate monitor, calories burned crowd. There's all of these little niches and factions, each wanting a different set of 100 features. But being open source, if you get somebody that wants it badly enough to do it, or to fund it, to have someone else do it, if you can get the specs, then pay an intern to actually sling the bits if you're not a programmer. You can work on it yourself.
How much of the time during your day or during a week would you spend on continually enhancing GPS Babel?
It depends. I would say on average somewhere between 15 and 20 hours a week.
What do you do when a new version of Garmin comes out? Do you lose sleep? Do you sweat it out? How do you integrate GPS Babel using any new interfaces? Are you reverse engineering? Are you taking those puppies apart?
I was the first one to implement Garmin's USB protocol. I happen to have things like a USB protocol analyzer laying around my office. I happen to have access to insanely expensive, very specialized tools to do that sort of thing. Garmin eventually did document the USB protocols. Sometimes it actually matches what they implement. Their docs have gotten a lot better lately. About the time that GPS Babel became the GPS interface for Google Earth, it became way easier to get the attention of the GPS guys.
Now it's like, you better work with me.
Suddenly, putting, you know, an email address and a unit in my hands, and poof, it works with Google Earth, became a much, much better way to work for all of us than even a year or two ago when it was, what? You're the guy that can't sell your software and you give it away for free? Is this a hoax? There are more doors open now than a year or two.
If a new unit is coming out from one of the handheld GPS manufacturers, are they working with you so you get a unit early enough so that you can have something ready for by the time it hits the market?
It does depend on the vendor. Garmin in particular has paid much more attention to compatibility, and you know they will actually spot check Google Earth before they ship a unit these days. That's a huge help. You know, if they can, you know, they've got my number, I've got theirs. If we need to ship boxes to and from each other, that can happen. GPS Babel has a crazy amount of math that, honestly, I'm glad I don't understand it. Ron Parker, a developer in the Fort Wayne area, who I think actually was a math major, he's done a number of our good filtering features, things like caches along a route, points inside a polygon. There is a mind-numbing amount of math involved in those things, trying to figure out whether a point is inside or outside an irregularly shaped polygon based on the number of times it crosses the vertex between the closest... I mean, it makes my brain hurt. GPS Babel is written with very much a performance-conscious bend, just because I'm kind of psycho on that sort of thing. You know, if it takes much more than a couple seconds to do anything, I stick it in profilers to figure out what and how we can make it better. You know, it is all written in C. It is compiled. I do builds for Linux and Windows and Mac and test it. You know, I have automated test suites on all these things. I routinely exercise it on out to a couple million, yes, million waypoints. There was a dude in Texas who had marked something like 40 million points. It was something to do with oil drilling. And he was using GPS Babel to figure out, you know, of these 40 million points, throughout everything that's more than, that's closer than 5 feet from something else. In your head, draw 40 million points. Now,
okay,
figure
wait,
out the math
I'm still
of
doing
how
it.
To get rid of the ones that aren't in a clump. He did trip some kind of pathological performance stuff, and you know, on a Pentium 4, this stuff would take, you know, as much as 40 or 50 seconds to run. And
have you worked at all with geocaching.com or Groundspeak in any aspect? Because I know recently they implemented their own caches along a route feature. Is that something that they just pulled out of math? Was there some connection with GPS Babel that they were able to use?
I leaned on them, on Jeremy and Rain, pretty hard in the early days. Like, you know, you have the stuff as a shapefile. GPS Babel knows how to read shapefiles. We know how to build arcs. Load GPS Babel behind the scenes. I'll do whatever mods it takes to make caching along a route work. Rain is a developer at Groundspeak.
Okay.
Rain contacted me and asked, you know, for some of the math involved, and it turns out that he was able to do it in the database itself without incurring an additional copy out, which would have been necessary for an external tool. And he was able to use some good features of the Google Maps to make it very easy for users to upload their own routes, and I think he's done a pretty good job. So while GPS Babel isn't actually being used in that process, I've certainly had a number of conversations with the guys. Well, would I like to have more than 5 logs? Yes. Would I like enough to accumulate PQs over time and build them up myself? No.
Oh, is that why I only get 5 logs?
Only 5 logs in a pocket query.
Okay. Because I thought it was GSAC. I always say when GSAC could create this HTML output of the 20 or so caches that I want to select, I said, yeah, show me the last 10 or 15, and I'd only ever get 5. I guess that's because the source only gave me 5.
Unless you feed your PQs into GSAC over time, which has problems of its own.
Oh, so it will accumulate?
GSAC will, yes.
Ah, I hadn't thought about that. I usually don't. I just like wipe it out and start all over. Yeah, 5's good enough for me. It usually helps me find it anyway. But
the places where it falls down are when you're caching out of town and you get behind a powertrain, where the last 5 logs are found it from the coordinates before me, and then the next 4 are thanks TNSN TN. LNSL.
Right.
And you're like, if only I had log number 6 that said, dude, your coordinates bite, found 700 feet away at.
Right. Yeah.
I've tried to point out that one of the reasons why people are currently running pocket queries 3 and 4 times a week is to get log history. If they would give you 10, 20, I don't know what the right number is, but it's more than 5. Actually, even if I just have the hint that, you know, In the example I just listed, if I have the, dude, your coordinates suck, I found it from Herbert's coordinates.
Yeah.
Well, that tells me that it's findable. Just quit following the arrow. Because when I'm clinging to the side of a bluff in Alabama, I really want to be, thumbs up.
I wish I had log number 6 with me. I guess one question I didn't ask you was, how did you discover geocaching?
I bought my first receiver in 01 because at the time, I was a computer guy. It was the dot-com days, and I was traveling a lot on business. I am navigationally impaired. I am always lost. Huh. And I would wake up in some city that looked just like the city I woke up last week, and I was like, I just want a cheeseburger. And I want to be able to find my way back to the hotel. I had the GPS. I was using it for business travel. I was roaming around the internet looking for programming information on it. And I stumbled across geocaching. You know, I did the same thing everyone does. You pump in the zip code for your hometown. That sounds interesting. I never knew that was there. In Nashville Metro, which is the Davidson County Park District, went this permit system for geocaching. To submit a cache, you have to get approval, and it has to be moved after 6 months, and you have to renew it, and you have to submit a picture of the cache to its final location and description. You have to fill out forms so they can notify the bomb squad as they're dispatched, and it became kind of a chore to place caches in parks here, which kind of had the bad effect of running caching out of the parks. You know, you have to get outside of Nashville, fairly far outside, before you get into the you know, the land of many 100-acre parks.
The son may say, so, Mommy, there isn't a cache under every lamppost?
See, I get that a lot. And the reality is every cache or every city has good caches and bad caches. You know, Nashville had a reputation in the early days, you know, just because I think the growth here happened before it happened in other areas. I have found lamp poles, caches on both coasts and everywhere in between.
So when you started geocaching, were you living in Nashville?
Yes.
Was there an organization at that point of geocachers who got together and talked about geocaching?
See, it's funny you mention that. We do have a local organization, the Middle Tennessee Geocaching Club. We think we're the second oldest in the country. You know, it's probably one of those things like world's largest furniture store that, you know, can you really prove it or disprove
yeah.
it? Don't know.
But who's going to debate it and why would they?
But we organized in January of 02, which strangely was just a couple of weeks after I started. I started in December of 01. I was one of the founding officers of that. Also, names on that group that you would recognize in the St. Louis area, Joe GPS and Southpaw.
Brothers.
Brothers, and they were at that initial meeting as well. We do have a local group. I was an officer of that group for 4 years. This is the first year I have not served on it. Monkey Brad is the current president there. They work a lot with the parks, with handling the press, with, you know, work, you know, notification between the sites and the cachers, working to pick up abandoned caches. We do have a website, mtgc.org. We keep the money low just as a way of passing the plate once a year for shelter reservations, for website, for, you know, expenses brought up at picnics, that sort of thing. You know, we don't make a big deal about it. It's not like if you didn't pay your $5, we're going to have our bouncer kick you out of here. If you want to pay $5, pay $5. It manages to always just about exactly break even. Think that some people know that, you know, oh, gee, this is a $50 a day pavilion rental. You know, poof, more $5 has happened to show up. But no, the group here never bought into the Roberts Rule of Order. And, you know, we tried the written minutes. And when we got really honest about it, it's a social group. This group loves to cash, and they love to stand around and yak.
How about eat? Because we love to eat here.
With organizing the meetings, I would try to get a theme and a set of minutes going. And, you know, and today we have a guest speaker on how to treat snake bite wounds in the field or a trash out or something. And
yeah.
And those meetings were fun, but the cookie swaps were way better attended.
Was Geo Woodstock was the first one in Nashville?
No, the first one was in Louisville. I'm one of a fairly small group that's been to all four of them so far. The first one was in Louisville because it was more geographically central to the people that were targeted to attend. Joe GPS worked with Daryl, Show Me the Cash, to host Woodstock, you know, the initial one there. At that time, we had 7 of the top 10 finders.
Right, I remember seeing some of those pictures
there. Meeting for the first time.
Yeah.
The second one was in Nashville.
And
the third floor to the fourth Dallas.
Now, the one in Nashville, wasn't a lot of that sponsored by Joe GPS? I mean, didn't he have a fish fry? Or?
It's not exactly clear where the sponsorship came from, but it's pretty well known that Joe is a very generous guy. The fish fry was run by the cashier known as Rob. You know, who funded it, I'm not entirely certain. It really brought the locals together because hosting a Woodstock, even at that size, was a huge undertaking. I wish the guys in Raleigh luck. It's a lot of work. In Nashville, when we had Woodstock here, you know, we know that we have a lot of caches. Some folks did guided tours, and you know, if you really want long hikes, here's a van headed out to the big parks where long hikes can be had. If you really want Civil War history, we'll do a Civil War history tour. That kind of got extrapolated to even more extreme things in later Woodstocks. People are traveling from far, far away. The ones that make that trip are going to be the voracious, hardcore types.
When you think back about Woodstock 4, what's the first thing that comes to mind?
The silly moments I had with my friends while caching, which is a strange thing to remember because it's not like we don't do that, you know, a couple times a year anyway.
I think that's what Google Earth has helped a lot of people with now, is to be able to pre-plan where they're going or get a set of waypoints, and before they actually go out, say, oh, it couldn't be this one because, you know, that's sitting in the middle of somebody's house, so it must not be that waypoint.
It's helped the reviewers as well. When they can, your cache says it's in a park, but the coordinates you put are very clearly in the middle of Sam's Club.
Yeah.
it's like, oh, you typed a 5 when you meant a 6. Yeah, having worked with the guys at Google on the Earth product, that's an amazing set of technology. Some very smart guys working on it. Yeah, I sat in front of an ISDN connection for about 10 years because I do work remotely.
I didn't think I'd be able to do Skype calls with ISDN. I'm just barely on the edge. If I started to surf now, you'd hear it drop out.
Well, this is actually an ISDN line that you've called, but
yeah.
It's going in through a Cisco router to a real telephone. It's the cheapest way to get to office lines.
Robert, thanks for doing this on such short notice. You didn't have me prepared.
It's not really short notice. I remember blowing you off before I went to San Diego.
This has been up and coming for months now. Thank you for GPS Babel.
Thank you.
And all your
You're
hard
welcome.
Work on that.
Thanks for the call.
Bye.
This concludes the Slaga Podcast. For more information about the Slaga Group and geocaching in the St. Louis, Missouri area, go to www.geostl.com. Here's wishing you a strong signal and a trusty bearing.